This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 83 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Fruling, and with me, as always, is Mike Morrison. Today, we are going to be discussing one of my favorite original series episodes, The Conscience of the King. But, Mike, it is so good to be back recording. It has been over 3 months since we did an episode of Metatrex together.
It has been. Thanks to some computer problems, we had to take a hiatus, and I was going to say a brief hiatus, and then I had to walk that back, because 3 months doesn't seem very brief, but it's good to be back. Episode 82 that we just released, that was actually recorded 3 months ago, and we had to halt production because of computer issues I was having. Thankfully, I have a brand new computer sitting here on my desk, so that's great, and hopefully we'll keep on trucking on and on, bringing great Star Trek and philosophy discussion to our listeners.
It'll be a bit like riding a bike, except I feel like I have my philosophical training wheels on right now.
Yeah, hopefully it will be like riding a bike. I feel a little rusty, but it feels good to be back on mic. And this is a great episode to kind of put our feet in the proverbial water, so to speak. This was the beginning, really, of Star Trek's long love affair with Shakespeare. And I'm excited. I'm glad you chose this one. This is one of my favorite original series episodes as well. I think there's a ton, really, in terms of philosophical themes kind of woven throughout ethical problems, and it's a fascinating episode. And this crew, really, at this point, was still a new crew. We were getting to know the characters. It informs so much about Captain Kirk and how his crew felt about him. I think we saw something of Spock being very analytical and even critical in some ways that I'm not sure that we ever quite saw to that degree again. But, you know, Captain Kirk is a relatively new captain for him. And, you know, he spent years serving under Captain Pike, and it only seems reasonable that he would be analytical and somewhat critical. So I think character-wise, this was an interesting episode.
I hadn't really thought about the fact that this is where Shakespeare really gets introduced to Star Trek big time. I mean, this is a pretty early episode in the original series. Mm-hmm. It's season one, episode 13, I think.
Yeah.
And it's really Shakespeare heavy, and it's theatrical, and the whole episode feels theatrical in that way. It feels like the episode is a stage play, even the parts that aren't on stage.
Absolutely. And I really enjoy, and it seems like I've had this conversation at some other time, but one of the things that I really enjoy about this, and this is just quintessential 1960s television, is their use of light in this episode. And part of the reason why they use light in some interesting ways in the episode is the actress, Barbara Anderson, who plays Lenora, actually had a cold sore that developed while they were filming this. And so they had to come up with creative ways to hide it. So they played with light. But again, it didn't feel out of place or off-putting in any way, because this was very typical of how 1960s television used light in episodes to accentuate romantic scenes or dramatic scenes or scenes where, you know, a particular person is in danger oftentimes. they would convey that with really fascinating uses of light. And so I think there's a lot to really appreciate about this this episode and the theatrical nature of it.
I think what I love about the theatrical nature of this episode in general, and this is something all actors have to deal with to some extent, they play other people, right? It's their job as an actor to, you know, in some sort of method acting sense, become someone else. And inside this episode, we see the actor Caridian, who may or may not be the same individual as Kodos the Executioner, the person responsible for the deaths of, I think it was 4,000 individuals 4,000. In the episode. And the juxtaposition of the moral theme of the episode of whether or not it's possible to become a substantively different person to the point where you are accepted from moral responsibility of any of your previous actions. Can you change as an individual substantively to the point where you're off the hook, so to speak, after 20 years? But the juxtaposition of that with the theatrical nature of the episode, choosing to be an actor, portraying other people in an acting sense, is a really clever juxtaposition of themes.
I really appreciated and really enjoyed his very dramatic answer to Captain Kirk when Kirk confronts him and says, "Are you Kodos the Executioner?" In essence, he's saying, "Hey, Caridian the actor, are you actually Kodos the Executioner?" And I love the way, you know, Kodos kind of turns his back and he says, "I am Kodos, if it pleases you for me to be."
See, I actually like a slightly different moment from that conversation. When Kirk asks him, "Who were you 20 years ago?" And he says, "Younger."
Great answer.
That is a great answer, because I feel bad about certain things in my life, things I did 20 years ago that I would not do now, or at least would do differently now. And you probably feel the same thing, sure, about things in your life. And there's a sense in which that's a perfectly fine answer. Like, yeah, that was younger me. That's not me now. I've changed. And so what I'm interested in this episode is not so much the metaphysics of personal identity, because we've talked about metaphysics of personal identity on Metatrex many times. But I'm interested in kind of the moral sense of personal identity. Can you change substantively morally to the point where that's a perfectly valid excuse? The fact that you were younger 20 years ago does not make you culpable for those actions later in life, about anything. In this episode, it happens to be about the murder of 4,000 individuals, which Kodos tries to justify in his own mind about, you know, whose lives are worthy of saving and whose lives are worthy of sacrificing. So this is a very, you know, high stakes situation with thousands of lives involved, but you can drill down a little bit and say, this is true of any of us about anything in our past. You know, can we change and become a different moral individual than we used to be? Or do our past events kind of come with us through our entire life, justifiably so, no matter how much we change?
There's a couple of things I want to say there. I have to be honest, and I know this is opening a whole other can of worms for our Enterprise fans, but interestingly enough, one of the 4,000 people who presumably died under the hand of Kodos the Executioner was Hoshi Sato. It's one of the Mirror Universe episodes of Enterprise, and we get to see kind of her history, her bio, and it places her there on the planet, you know, during that time. So presumably
Tarsus IV.
So she was presumably one of the 4,000, although producers of the show said, no, don't take that with a grain of salt, because, you know, we didn't really intend for that to be seen. But that's the miracle of modern digital technology. We can freeze frame that sucker and read her bio, and we find out at least somebody sat down, and when they were faking her bio for the episode, they placed her on Tarsus, and she's one of the 4,000 that dies. So that makes it very personal. These aren't 4,000 nameless, faceless people, but this is a character that I personally care about. So that kind of takes the stakes of this to a whole different level, and it literally changes the way that I look at it. But you raised the question of personal identity, and this really becomes kind of the $64,000 question. You know, and I think about John Locke, who would hold that personal identity was a matter of psychological continuity, I think is the best way to put it. It's the idea that the self is founded on consciousness and memories. It's experiences rather than, you know, a substantive soul or even the body. If one would postulate that identity was directly linked to and indistinguishable from one's experiences or memories, I think there's an argument to be made that identity is formed and continues through time. That's not a very Cartesian point of view, to say the least, but I think there's an argument there to be said that really insinuates that those experiences and memories that maintain themselves through time are really tied to one's own identity, and that continues through time as well.
Well, it's hard to imagine what any sort of legal or moral system would be like that doesn't rely on this notion that you are the same individual over time. Again, not metaphysically, but in a moral sense. So you're still responsible for your actions, right? If that weren't the case, it would be very easy for anyone just to say, oh, I'm a different person now. I'm not responsible anymore for anything you're accused of, for any crime, for any moral failing. You can just say, oh, that's not me anymore, so I'm off the hook. you can't build a legal or moral system of responsibility around that. But undoubtedly, people do change over time. People do have changes of heart,
sure.
And people do learn lessons, and people do act differently down the road. And so my question, I think, is not so much the sharp dividing line, are you the same person, are you not the same person, but what exactly is that fuzzy gray area between justifiably saying I'm a different person in some relevant sense to this issue at hand versus getting off the hook too easily for things in your past?
Interestingly enough, we see this question being debated in courtrooms from time to time, Zachary, when, for instance, a question of memory is brought up. Oftentimes in perpetrating a crime or after the fact, the perpetrator themselves will have some type of lapse of memory. It might be a bump on the head that causes some type of amnesia, or, you know, whatever the case may be. There's a loss of memory. And so, you know, then it becomes a matter of can we or should we rather hold that person responsible for the crime when they can't even remember committing it? And oftentimes what usually ends up happening is the answer to that question is no, and that person is remanded to some type of physical care until that memory is restored. And if not, then eventually once the physical wounds are tended to, then that person is released. We've seen that happen, and to the victims, that doesn't seem much like justice. But that, you know, that is something that we've debated in our courtrooms here in our own world.
But that's a pretty extreme case. You're talking about an extreme discontinuity, sure, in memory, right? A total memory lapse, or not being able to remember a specific event. That's not what's going on inside this episode, right? It seems pretty clear. And a lot of it is subtextual, but you can tell from the way that the actor Caridian kind of looks off into the distance. Looks like he's remembering past events when Captain Kirk confronts him about possibly being Kodos. It's pretty clear that he remembers being Kodos. At least I read it that way. And so it's that kind of ordinary situation that I'm interested in, not this radical discontinuity of memory, but a substantive change over time where, in this case, Caridian seems to clearly remember being Kodos. So there's no sharp memory discontinuity here. But he's changed. You know, he was younger 20 years ago, even though when he reads the transcript of the speech that he gave before he executed the 4,000 people, it's clear that he doesn't make those words his own anymore. Either he doesn't believe it, or he doesn't identify with it anymore, even though there's a part of him that really does think, you know, humans should be strong and we should be anti-technology. And he still kind of has these convictions along those lines. So it leaves the viewer kind of wondering, has he really substantively changed or not? I don't think we really know. But when Kirk first confronts Caridian, I read it as Caridian looking off into the distance, reflecting back on his life and saying, that's not me anymore. I was younger then, and not admitting to being Kodos, but kind of poetically saying, I've learned a lot since then. And then he kind of backpedals on that shortly thereafter. So for me, there are two questions philosophically here that I find interesting. One is whether this kind of gradual change can ever happen to such a degree that moral culpability for past events ceases to apply? You know, is it a certain amount of time, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? What do you have to prove or display to be able to sufficiently demonstrate to other people that you've made that change, that it's not just an act, to to harken back to the acting theme of the episode? Because Caridian is a great actor and Kirk doesn't really know, has he changed or is he just fulfilling another role? Is he just acting? So that's one question that I have. The other question that I have is whether there are any sharp discontinuities in a good sense. Well, you've described kind of a sharp discontinuity of memory. Like, I don't remember being that person, sure. So mm-hmm. I'm off the hook. But are there any radical conversion experiences, for lack of a better term, a flash of insight that changes your entire being or changes your entire character? Kind of, you'll appreciate this. Like, I'm thinking of Saul on the way to Damascus, yes. Becoming Paul, like a conversion experience where you're literally a different person in some sense, but in a very quick, rapid transition kind of way. I get the sense that in the case of Caridian and Kodos, that it's the former. This is more of a gradual transition, and it might still be an act. We're not really sure, but it's not a radical conversion experience. It's more of a gradual change. But I think a lot of people that I know have described having a radical conversion experience, where from one moment to the next, their whole life has changed or reoriented, or they feel differently, or they see things in a different way, or they don't act the same way. And it's a much sharper contrast between their old selves and their new selves than what we see with Caridian and Kodos. And so two questions. Is either one of these ever really possible? And if they are possible, if these kind of personal identity conversions in a moral sense do happen, do they ever get you off the hook morally, even if they do happen?
And those are great questions. And I can only speak from my own experience. Your question about, you know, a radical conversion experience. I can say that, yes, I experienced in my own life a radical conversion experience. I can literally take you to the place where I had that experience. I know the date. I know the time. I mean, it's very much ingrained in who I am. And I can say without a shadow of a doubt that I went to that place with one sense of self, and I got up from that place an entirely different person. And I don't say that just on my own. I say that because the people around me also saw that change. My friends, my family, they saw a radical change in me. And I didn't go to that place flawed and walk away perfect by any means. But, you know, I have experienced a radical conversion. I think it's interesting that you would mention Saul of Tarsus. So Saul of Tarsus in the Bible was...
Tarsus 4, by the way.
Yeah. So, I don't think that this was accidental, what they've done here. Caridian Kodos, Saul and Paul. Saul being the Kodos, the executioner, and Saul literally was an executioner of sorts. He was a very devout Jew, a Pharisee, meaning that he was a very rigid thinking Jew, and he was a persecutor of the church. He was Jesus's followers. He persecuted them. He literally held the coats while a man named Stephen was stoned to death. And he had gone and gotten papers to arrest, torture, kill as many Christians as he could. And that's literally what he was doing when he was on the road to Damascus. And he had a radical conversion experience. He saw Christ, and he actually went blind for a while. And he was blind for a few days, in fact, until he had prayed and literally the scales had fallen from his eyes and he saw the error of his way. And so he assumed a new name to go with a new identity. But here's the interesting thing about the story. In the book of Acts in the New Testament, the writer and historian physician Luke records that he didn't get such a warm reception among the Christians. It wasn't, oh, great, you know, hey, we got another one. Come on in, Brother Paul. It wasn't that at all. In fact, it was exactly the opposite. There was a lot of suspicion. There was fear. He shows up, hey, I've had this radical conversion experience, and, you know, the disciples are having these, kind of, you know, breakout sessions going, guys, I don't believe it. It's a bunch of, here's a great Greek word for all of you New Testament scholars out there. It was a bunch of baloney. You know, this was just literally hooey that he was, you know, he was a flimflam man, and he's going to suck us in, and he's going to infiltrate us, and then he's going to just wipe us out. And that was the kind of suspicion that Paul got. But
they're worried he'll go all Kodos on
them. They were worried he was going to go all Kodos. And frankly, he was getting suspicion from the other side as well. You know, he just wasn't getting love from anybody. The Christians were not receiving him well, and he was making enemies of his old friends. And so I think this is a very interesting thing that you would invoke here. And I think it was certainly on the minds of the writers as they created this character, asking this question, is such a change possible?
Honestly, Mike, this is not a connection I had intended to make but when we started recording, but it sounds so obvious now that we say it. You know, just like Saul had a conversion experience and became Paul, we have Kodos having some sort of experience in a longer time frame, but becoming Kodos. We have the location of Tarsus in there, for goodness sakes, which I refuse to think is accidental at this point. thanks for pointing that out. But what's interesting to me is they only use... But what's interesting to me is that they didn't really draw the full parallel. Kodos doesn't seem to have had that conversion experience. He just aged. He just got older, and he started taking on different personas as an actor. And they didn't really...
I totally get what you're saying. And I think to some degree, Zachary, that might be the commentary in and of itself. This may be to some degree a commentary about... literally about Saul, but figuratively speaking, metaphorically speaking, it could be about that kind of conversion experience. They may be saying that, you know, people don't have these ready, because we know that there's a lot of commentary about, you know, faith and spiritual. I mean, we are deconstructing gods in the original series, where we're chalking things up to science that we once thought were miraculous. And so maybe to some degree that's the commentary that exists here. They're saying, hey, these kinds of experiences, they don't happen radically, but people tend to change over time, and they mellow, and they lament their previous experiences, or they feel bad about, you know, something that they've done in life, and then it becomes a question of, well, is that person to be held morally responsible for their actions when they were younger?
I'm not convinced that the writers had that strong of a commentary on Paul in mind, but let's kind of run with that notion and assume that maybe they did intend to actually comment on the historical
Paul. I think it's certainly possible.
There are two possible ways this could have happened. One is to be very critical, right? They could be criticizing the notion of a conversion experience, throwing into question all of the things that Paul did, right? And the subsequent cultural and religious movement that emerged out of that, right? Star Trek is very critical of religion, and that is a perfectly plausible interpretation of what could be going on here, I think. Just questioning the whole notion of a conversion experience. And I think that bears out in the episode a little bit. We're left wondering whether Kodos has really genuinely converted to a better person, or whether it's just an act. Alternatively, you could read this as critical of the notion of a radical conversion experience in an instantaneous sense, in favor of a more gradual conversion. And Star Trek often has this perspective that we as humans, in the long term, can learn from our mistakes and become better people and improve ourselves and become the best versions of ourselves. But that's not something that happens overnight. That's something that takes time and effort and work and reflection and conscious effort. And so that reading sounds like a much more positive reading. you know, if this is even a commentary on Paul in the first place, which is still a little specious, I'm not sure there's quite enough there to say that was part of the writer's intention. But it sounds like a kinder, gentler point to make, which is that we like the idea of change over time. We like the idea that people can learn from their mistakes, but we still kind of question the instantaneous conversion. But Kodos, in this case, maybe he really has done it and he's become Caridian, a better human being.
And unfortunately, within the episode, what we discover is the sins of the father are visited to the sons, or in this case, the daughter. So poor Lenora, she is a whole other level kind of crazy.
I'm glad you thought to mention Kodos's daughter, Lenore, because she's an interesting case because she almost refuses to see her father in a bad light. She can't understand that he is a person who would do those things. Even though she's totally willing to take up the knife, so to speak, and eliminate his enemies, she sees him in fundamentally a good light. And that's so true about people in general, though, isn't it? I mean, when we're close to people, if we know people, if we're related to them, we tend to see them in a favorable light.
Without a doubt.
And are more willing to entertain the notion that they've changed or overlook their faults in the first place.
But I find it interesting that she is so willing to do the unthinkable. I mean, even at the end of the episode, Caridian Kodos, he is absolutely devastated that she would kill to protect him. And he says to her, "You've brought more blood to my hands and to your own." And, you know, he's devastated by this. And
the waters of Neptune can't rinse the blood
very dramatic.
Says,
yeah. And there's references to her being Lady Macbeth in the episode. And so I think that there's kind of some irony there as well at the end of the episode. But Dr. McCoy, at the very end of the episode, Dr. McCoy insinuates that, you know, this is chalk this up to mental illness. And so oftentimes mental illness is generational. So then it raises the question of, you know, did mental illness play a part in, you know, what happened with Kodos and his own, 4,000 lives and eugenics. And it's just, it's so unthinkable. And he obviously looks back on it and he seems genuinely sad that this was, you know, this was his past life.
Kodos describes himself as having to make a difficult choice. Some people had to live, some people had to die, and it was his burden to decide who lived and who died. Mm-hmm. And when you're in that situation, if you're the unlucky individual, maybe the lucky individual, but the unlucky individual to be in that position to decide who lives and who dies, you have to go by something. And he basically chooses his own intuitions about who's worthy of saving and who's not worthy of saving. He doesn't really try to justify it in any objective way. Although he does seem to have this sense of, you know, some people are stronger, some people are weaker, some people can, you know, pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and some people are, you know, relying on this, you know, unhuman, mechanized, electronicized society, as he calls it. So he has some sort of rubric for deciding who lives and who dies. And, you know, we don't get to see that fleshed out fully about what he really means there. It's just a couple of snippets. But I think he views himself as an unfortunate situation. And what I love about that conversation that Kirk has with Lenore in the observation deck is that she basically says Kirk is in the same position. She calls him Caesar of the stars, for goodness sakes. He's in the position all the time to decide who lives and who dies. Every time he fires phasers,
yes.
Every time they go to war, every time they're in a battle, he gets to play God in that way. In the same way that Kodos was in the unfortunate position of having to decide which 4,000 people live and which 4,000 people die. So that's a very interesting question. Is there a substantive difference between someone like Kodos, who has his own view of things about what, you know, who's worthy of living and who's worthy of dying, and someone like Kirk, who all the time has to decide, I'm saving this group of people versus saving that group of people in a difficult situation as captain of a starship? Structurally, they're very similar, right? If you're in a no-win situation, the Kobayashi Maru kind of scenario, right? If it's us versus them, then you're totally justified in choosing yourselves. You've made a decision. We're choosing ourselves, saving some people versus saving other people. And I think Lenore makes a really interesting point in trying to call him out on it and saying, you're no different than my father. you are Kodos, out in the stars. You're Caesar of the stars, as she calls him. I love the phrase Caesar of the stars.
Yeah.
Because Kirk is accused of being godlike. Because Kirk is accused of having delusions of godhood, especially in like the trouble with Tribbles. And I think this is something we've kind of lost over time in our connotations with Kirk. Kirk is the person who, as captain of the starship, who decides who lives and who dies. And that is a terrible burden of responsibility. And if you're on the other end of the spectrum, if you're not in control, or if you are the person who ends up being, you know, killed in a firefight, that kind of thing, you could look like Kirk is out there playing Caesar with the galaxy. And I think that it's really interesting to draw the parallel. And if the analogy doesn't hold, if Kodos and Kirk are substantively different in some way, then we have to decide why exactly are they different. Because every time Kirk orders the phasers to fire, he's essentially playing Kodos, according to his daughter. So what exactly is that difference that makes Kirk an okay guy and Kodos such a bad person?
Well, what they don't tell you is that Kirk is actually credited with being the only Starfleet officer to ever beat this test at the academy called the Kobayashi Koridian.
Don't you see? All the ghosts are dead. I've buried them.
It's the no-win situation where a wannabe dictator has to decide who lives and who dies on the... But Kirk doesn't believe in no-win situations, so everyone lives.
I can picture it now. They set it up in a simulator on the holodeck. You get to play Kodos for an hour, and if you can get your way out of the situation without killing 4,000 people, you've won.
Yep, you've mastered the Kobayashi Koridian.
You've left me nothing!
Well, and I think that's the thing. With Kirk, and any Starfleet captain, really, but with Kirk in particular, maybe more so with Picard even, but starship captains are always looking for a better option. If there's a third way, if there's a way to retreat, if there's a way to not sacrifice lives, they're going to find it. And they'll go above and beyond to try to get out of that no-win scenario.
Sure.
It doesn't always work. Sometimes they do have to fire the phasers, right? But I get the sense that Kodos the Executioner pulled the trigger on 4,000 people a little quickly. Like, we didn't really learn that he tried to find a third option besides... I mean, he talks about food rationing and all the things he tried to do, and maybe he feels like he exhausted all the other options. We don't really know for sure, right? We're not treated to seeing the events that are referenced inside the episode. But now we've got two interpretations. One is Kodos tried a bunch of things. None of them worked. He had to save some people. Other people had to die. Otherwise, everyone was going to die, so he had to kill some of them. Is it plausible that he did exhaust all of his other options? The other alternative is that he just pulled the trigger too quickly and he didn't try hard enough to find that third option.
Yeah, and I think the unfortunate thing here is that you could almost take a situation like, you know, Germany in the 1930s, in which a doctrine of Germany for Germans, literally, was being preached by a man named Adolf Hitler. And things weren't good in Germany after World War One. I mean, when the Kaiser, basically stepped down or was removed, however you choose to look at post-World War One dynamics in Germany, it sent that nation in a tailspin and allowed for the rise of someone charismatic like Adolf Hitler, who is preaching, you know, Germany for Germans. And that was a very popular rhetoric because World War One had been so demoralizing to the German people. But the unfortunate, ugly underbelly of that is that, you know, millions of Jews were going to die in concentration camps. Now, you can paint that in a very gray way if you really wanted to, much like you could look at, this situation in Tarsus and food rationing and, you know, 4,000 people, eugenics. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that was going on in Germany pre and post, the beginning of World War II. And it's ugly. It's evil incarnate. It's ugly. And, the thing that I love about this episode is that you're kind of looking at this old man and you're thinking, you know, my goodness, look, you know, he's 20 years now. He's been an actor. He's got a beautiful young daughter and, you know, there's no way. But if you kind of refocus a little bit, it becomes a little bit more black and white. And again, I brought Hoshi into the conversation because, you know, that's the point to where these weren't nameless, faceless people for me. But now, oh, we got to, you know, I, I'm putting myself in universe. I'm saying, oh, now it's somebody I know. For instance, Riley doesn't have any problem inside this episode making a determination whether or not Kodos / Caridian is guilty. He knows because it's personal. And then you have this whole other, you know, the law makes a distinction. Even for Captain Kirk, if he fires phasers, there's a good chance that he may be court-martialed. Now, the thing I think a lot of people misunderstand about court-martial isn't removing him from command. A court-martial is simply reviewing his command decisions to determine whether they were just or unjust. And if the determination is that they were unjust, then he's removed from command. If they determine, oh, Captain Kirk, you didn't have, you know, you had option A, you had option B, and, you know, you made the best possible decision, you took the best possible path, and he's returned to command. And if they find that, you know, Captain Kirk, what about option C over here? You didn't even think about that. Well, you know, I know, but, well, you're not fit for command. And that's basically a court-martial in a nutshell. So even for that Starfleet officer who's his own Caesar of the Stars, there are consequences when they make these decisions.
You know, it's interesting because it all seems to boil down to what Kodos's intentions were, and all we know is what he says in the episode. Mm-hmm. We're not treated to his inner monologue, right? On the one hand, if you have to make a difficult choice, some people are going to live, some people are going to die, it's plausible to let the strong survive. If some people are sick, if some people are weak, if some people are going to drag everyone down and we have to decide, let's, again, just kind of assuming, granting the premise that not everyone can survive and hard choices have to be made, then it's plausible that, you know, keeping the strong and sacrificing the weak is... it's a way to make the decision about who lives and who dies. I don't know if it's the best decision. I can't think of one better off the top of my head than that. So I'm trying to help Kodos out here and help make his case. Like, I was in a hard position. Some people had to live. Some people had to die. So I tried to save the strong ones to give us the best fighting chance going forward. You know, is that if you kind of say it with a little gusto, does that make it a little more plausible? Like, I tried my best and some people had to live and some people had to die. And I just figured we'd sacrifice the weak and keep the strong. And that was going to give us the best fighting chance going forward. You know, is that, if you say it in the right tone, does that give it the kind of moral okayness about it, about what his intentions are? You know, was he trying to be a good person, or did he have some sort of dark eugenics program in mind, a la Nazi Germany? You know, we don't really know. They use the word eugenics in the episode, but I don't think Kodos himself thinks of it as eugenics, not in that dark sense. He does seem to think that some human characteristics are better than others. He doesn't like the reliance on technology. He thinks it's important for people to be strong on their own in some sense. So he does have some beliefs about human virtues, and he seems willing to sacrifice the people that don't have virtues that align with his. So he's not making the decision willy-nilly. And it does seem plausible that saving the strong and sacrificing the weak in a tough situation is plausible, if you say it right. Again, I'm trying to help him out. I don't know if I really believe this, but
yeah, because I can completely push back against that and say, you know, morality aside, I think you can argue it's just simply unnatural. You know, there's something very unnatural about that. You know, why not let nature take its course? Why not let things unfold as they should, as they will on their own? I mean, the same argument that you're making for Kodos, you know, one could make about, and I'm not pinpointing Hitler specifically, but one could make for, you know, a historical figure like Hitler, you know, again, in a very crushed economy with limited resources. He's talking about Germany for Germans, and he's making a case for, you know, these people who aren't Germans. They're using up our resources. They're dragging us down. They're littering our purity. And so for many, that doesn't necessarily seem like a dark agenda.
I think, though, it's even more insidious than that, because it's not just a matter of certain people dragging us down. Like with Nazi Germany, the medical experiments, the sort of bad research that was done, there was a conscious effort. Well, there was a conscious effort to try to instill this idea that Jewish people were inferior, not just dragging this down, but inferior in some way. Right. And that is what Kodos is essentially saying. Some people are more superior and some people are less superior. So we're going to sacrifice the inferior ones. But that entire line of reasoning hinges on being able to make the case that some people are superior and some people are more inferior. And that is what they were trying to do with Jewish people in Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. And it's terrible that that's the case. But that's the only thing that makes that plausible. You know, you can't kill a bunch of people willy-nilly. It can't be arbitrary, right? It can't just be because they're dragging us down economically. You have to kind of make the case that a certain group of people are inferior, and that's what's so insidious and terrible about that part of the
Absolutely.
Holocaust. There's so many things that are terrible about it, but about that in particular, right? It's taking some mental rubric about what a strong group of people is versus a weak group, or certain ideal traits versus non-ideal traits, applying that to a group of people and using that as the dividing line for who lives and who dies.
Right.
And that is essentially what Kodos has done. He does have some mental rubric about what, you know, proper human virtues are. He thinks some people don't have them, and that's his rubric. You know, those 4,000 people don't make the cut, so they're the ones to go. And if you put it in those terms, that sounds a lot more like Nazi Germany than the nice, benevolent Kodos who is in a difficult position and has to decide who lives and who dies. Well, speaking of Kodos and his views on human nature and his views on human virtues, it's interesting to me that he takes this notion that some people are just strong and they embody these proper human virtues, and that technology, he calls it a mechanized, electronicized society, is in conflict with that individual strength, that human fortitude. I forget the exact phrase that he uses in the episode, but he has this very anti-technology bent, and I have a hard time understanding why exactly that is the dividing line for him. And there's this really interesting discussion where Kirk comes along and says, oh, well, no, that's not the case. Humans use technology to make tools and do things and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's part of our strength. And Kodos seems to view it as a weakness. And I was just having a hard time understanding why this anti-technology technophobia was incorporated into an episode that, to me, doesn't feel like it really needs that theme added into the main theme we've been talking about. But I don't know if you saw them being more complimentary than I see them being.
No, and quite frankly, I had a difficult time trying to connect this to sort of this overall philosophical theme that I saw woven into the storyline. And it seems that both Caridian and his daughter Lenore hold this point of view. She asks Kirk about, you know, the women of your world, and kind of insinuates that they're not really women. And I think that's very fascinating. Caridian says to Kirk, quote, "I find your use of the word mercy strangely inappropriate, Captain. Here you stand, the perfect symbol of our technological society, mechanized, electronicized, and not very human. You've done away with humanity, the striving of man to achieve greatness through his own resources. We've armed man with fools. The striving for greatness continues." That's interesting. End quote. That's interesting to me. His take that technology and mechanization would remove our humanity. It just seemed out of place to me, because I just don't see the connection to, and maybe his argument, maybe his whole argument in that was, How can you judge me for doing something very human? I don't know. It's difficult. And my only take on that, Zachary, is that his commentary, is that his defense, even, that what I did was very human, and it's hard for you to understand in your mechanized technological world you live in. I don't know.
I feel like I understand Lenore's point better than I understand Kodos's about this, right? I I guess I understand this idea that if 4,000 people are going to die anyway, you might as well put them out of their misery. Is that the argument that he's making, that I took the human route and I decided to euthanize these 4,000 people before their natural demise to prevent them from suffering? Is it some sort of utilitarian argument about preventing the needless suffering of 4,000 people?
I just have to say, I don't know. It just seems to me like that's his whole argument. I did something very human. In fact, Lenore says to Kirk, she accuses him of being like his ship, powerful and not human. Quote, there is no mercy in you. If he is Kodos, then I've shown him more mercy than he deserves. That was Kirk's response. If he is Kodos, then I've shown him more mercy than he deserves. Lenore's got the same sentiment here. You're like your ship. You're powerful. You're not human. There's no mercy in you. I mean, is the commentary here, We shouldn't look back on human cruelty and call it cruel? It's hard for us to understand what it means. I don't know. It seems like the whole defense here is that, you know, we're human beings and we did human things. I mean, there's even this throwaway line by Spock in the episode where they're kind of commenting on Kirk's relationship with Lenore, which frankly, you know, he's a 33-year-old guy chasing after a 19-year-old girl who's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. So, you know, Spock and Bones are having this kind of conversation about it. And even Spock says, you know, Bones says, hey, you want a drink here, Spock? You know, he's trying to pour his buddy a drink. And you know, my father's race was spared the dubious benefits of alcohol. And McCoy says, now I know why they were conquered. It was just kind of this throwaway line. You know, they kind of, it says a lot and it says nothing. The chain of command is often a noose. Again, it almost seems like we're trying to defer blame on the stress of command, the weight of our own humanity, and we're groping for reasons why humans do human things.
Well, there are a lot of threads to weave together here. One thread that's interesting that I hadn't thought of is this thread about mercy, because Kodos seems to be saying, I took the path of mercy. 4,000 people were going to die. I had to decide who. I wanted to prevent needless suffering, so I executed them, and that was the human thing to do. He looks at Kirk and the Enterprise and 23rd century futuristic society as mechanized, cold, not very human. And he basically challenges Kirk. You're part of that world. You look at me and you don't see mercy. You are in the position you're accusing me of having been in, which is making these hard decisions, deciding who's going to live, who's going to die. Lenore basically says the same thing to Kirk. You are in the position of being Caesar in the stars. You're not very human. You're very cold. You are the thing you're accusing my father of being. McCoy basically says something very similar by saying that the chain of command can sometimes be like a noose. You're always in danger of becoming the thing that you hate, the one who decides who lives and who dies. Kirk could become a Kodos in the right situation or the wrong situation. Spock even criticizes Kirk in this episode. He says he's not acting very much like the captain, is he, Dr. McCoy?
Yeah, exactly.
So is the real target of this episode not Kodos, but is the real thing to be criticized power? That the notion that that being in power in any situation, whether it's Kodos as governor of Tarsus IV, whether it's Kirk in charge of the Enterprise, that eventually that results in having to decide who lives and who dies. And you can become the thing that you hate in the blink of an eye in that situation, even if you're trying to take the moral high ground like Kirk seems to be doing. And McCoy basically says to Kirk, Kirk, what are you going to do if you catch the guy? Are you going to, you know, cut off his head right here? Are you going to, you know, murder him and execute him right here? In parentheses, you're going to become just like Kodos if you do those kinds of things. So take a chill pill. So it could just be that the real target of this episode is just the notion of power and the notion that power can always lead to being something like Kodos. But the more I think about these different threads, the more I think that Kirk is the real target of critique here.
I think you're right to some degree. I remember growing up with my grandfather being this very larger than life kind of influential man in my life. But it's funny that oftentimes he would, in some ways, criticize the ease that my generation was growing up in, a la the 1970s.
And juxtaposing
that with the difficulties of his life in the 20s and 30s growing up.
Undoubtedly, there's a difference there.
There's a difference. And so there was a lot of criticism to some degree about how easy I had it. It's funny because I find myself from time to time saying things to my daughter like, you have it so easy. You just go get on the internet. You got all this information and, you know, we're living in the information. And I had to go to the library and books and, you know. So I feel like to some degree that this is like a conversation between two generations that are critical to some degree of one another. Kirk being very critical for kind of the hard choices, the human choices that Kodos had to make, and the older generation Kodos being very critical of this kind of disconnect between, you know, Kirk and morality and mercy and, you know, you'll never know how hard these decisions were that I had to make because you got this computer to do it for you, young man. And it feels like that kind of conversation that's going on throughout this whole. And so I think there's a juxtaposition here about the hardships of the bygone generation and, you know, the current ease of the current generation. That's what it feels like.
I'm glad you thought to mention this. As you were talking, I was reminded of something I hadn't thought about in a long time. Back in my senior year of high school in our world history class, we had to do an exercise known as Truman on Trial. The class was split into halves. One half of the class had to, in a mock court kind of setting, defend Truman for having dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mm. And the other half of the class had to be the prosecutors. And it was a very interesting exercise. And a quick shout out to my world history teacher, Mrs. Warren, and anyone from my high school who's listening to this. I know a couple of you are. But I hadn't thought about this in a long time. And it occurred to me while you were talking that is a very common defense, that there's no way you could understand the difficulty of the situation we had to face and the difficult decisions that had to be made in that time period, in that setting. You weren't there, so you young whippersnappers have no business criticizing the decisions of the past in that way. You weren't there. You can't understand. Of course, you can learn about the past. You can talk about contextual relevance and things that are relevant morally to a given situation, but there are nuances that are always lost in translation. Is that kind of defense a plausible defense, the notion that you future people can't understand the difficult decisions of the past, and so you have no business criticizing us for it? That could be a line of reasoning that Kodos is taking, that you, young whippersnapper Captain Kirk, can't understand the difficult decision I had to face, and so you have no business criticizing me for it, and that's the end of the story. I can imagine a conversation between members of two different generations invoking this notion that certain things from the past are not possible to be understood by people in the future, that unless you were there, you won't be able to understand it. I think historians would largely disagree with that. I mean, you can't totally reconstruct the past.
Right.
You can reconstruct it to some degree. You can look at different people's perspectives. You can always get additional evidence. It seems to me that it's overly quick to dismiss the perspective of future generations altogether and say that they can't understand the perspective of previous generations. Undoubtedly, we can look at evidence, we can gather different perspectives, and we can reconstruct the past to some degree, albeit imperfectly. I just don't think this kind of reasoning holds up, because in this mock conversation between two people, one person would say, you weren't there, you can't understand. Why can't the other person just say, I'm here right now. Explain it to me. And then criticize it on its own merits, right? I don't see that that line of reasoning carries any weight if, from an objectivity standpoint. Even if there's a degree of translation difference between two different generations, you can just say, well, you're standing right here. Explain it to me. Or we can say we have the eyes of memory, as Tuvok's older Vulcan master mentor said in that episode of Voyager. You know, we can look at the past and we can reconstruct it, and we can say with some degree of moral objectivity that certain things are morally right and certain things are morally wrong. We have to be able to do that, to say things like the Holocaust were wrong.
Sure.
Right. And this amounts to someone like, you know, Kodos playing someone like Hitler saying, you can't understand the difficult decision I had to make when I, you know, committed the atrocities of the Holocaust. That line of reasoning just doesn't hold up.
But I do have to say that I think we're onto something here, in that I do believe that these are men from two different generations basically saying, in essence, you couldn't possibly understand. And I think that lends itself to the original question that we ask at the top of the podcast, and that is it possible for him to change over time? Did these 20 years really affect some change in him? Is he Caridian or is he Kodos? Did that 20 years make a difference, or is it as Captain Kirk says, is the play over? Has it been over for 20 years?
I think what betrays the fact that he hasn't really become Caridian, that he still is fundamentally Kodos, is the fact that he feels the need eventually to justify his decision.
I agree with you completely. The fact that he's defending his actions tells me that he hasn't changed at all.
When Kirk first confronts him and he says, who were you 20 years ago? And he says, younger. That's when he's the most sympathetic. If he had shut his mouth right there, you could plausibly say he's learned his lesson. He gets it. I see the look in his eyes. He's not trying to justify what he did. He gets it, right? And then he opens his mouth again. And he says, oh, but I really did the right thing because some people had to live and some people had to die and blah, blah, blah. And he goes into this whole monologue about why what he did was right. Or Kodos, in irony quotes, right? That Kodos guy did all these things.
Blood thins, the body fails, one is finally grateful for a failing memory. And you think, oh man, this poor old guy living with the stain of guilt from his past. But then he keeps talking.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned guilt, because we've talked about guilt in a culpability sense, but there's also guilt in the kind of emotional sense, right? I think you can run the same questions. I don't know if we have time to do that in all of its glory, but it's at least worth mentioning that, you know, if you've changed over time, to what extent do you need to feel quote unquote guilty over things you've done in your past, or to what extent can you let that emotional burden of guilt go? In the episode, I don't think we can really tell either way, because I think we're still left hanging a little bit at the end of the episode about whether Kodos has become Caridian in some substantively different moral sense. But whether he's legally culpable or morally culpable or not, would he need to feel guilty anymore after those 20 years, after he's changed substantively? Or would that, is it the exact same line of reasoning, or is there any difference there about the emotion of guilt versus the culpability of guilt?
Or is there a poetic answer in the fact that he throws himself in front of Captain Kirk and takes the phaser fire and subsequently dies?
Well, there is a little redemption theme there, right? Yeah, he did a self-sacrificing act at the end, and that, you know, we do, it's an abstract concept, but we have this concept of redemption. Has he redeemed himself in that situation?
And it's one of the things, I think, Zachary, that makes this such a compelling episode. It really does have a lot tied into it. It raises, as Star Trek always does, probably more questions than it answers. I think, though, in the end, I just don't think he's genuinely changed. Does he feel badly about it? Yeah, hindsight's 20/20. But has Kodos the man changed?
He seems to imply he would do it all over again.
He does. He absolutely, that was exactly the point that I was going to make. He justifies his actions. He gives every indication that, given the same circumstances, he would do exactly what he did over again. And Captain Kirk, you couldn't possibly understand it because you live in this age of technology and sterility, and you just don't get it. You just don't get what it is to carry the weight of that kind of humanity.
Would he always have taken a phaser for Captain Kirk?
Yeah, 20 minutes earlier, I don't know. You know, a lot can happen in 20 minutes, Zachary. Man can change in 20 minutes. We are rolling up on an hour, and we've been talking about this, and there is another aspect, another element here that I want to get in. But this is definitely one of those episodes that I would love to be able to sit down with the writer of the episode and have this conversation, because I think there is so much insight to be gained. And I think us sitting here, we could talk for 3 hours and never mind all of the great stuff that's just packed in this episode. But I want to talk about this idea of Riley, Bruce Hyde, by the way, as Kevin Riley, one of my favorite characters. I only got to see him a couple of times. This also featured Lieutenant Leslie, another favorite character. But I love Riley, and we get Riley in this episode. He actually plays a big part in this episode. He was there at Tarsus. He, you know, directly affected by what happened, and he is hell-bent on putting an end to Kodos the Executioner. And for that matter, so is Captain Kirk. I mean, McCoy and Kirk have that conversation. You mentioned it earlier. You know, McCoy asks him, hey, do you play God? Do you carry his head through the corridors in triumph? That won't bring back the dead, Jim. And Kirk responds and says, no, but they may rest easier. So even Kirk feels a sense of moral obligation to avenge those deaths.
Well, this is one of the justifications for punishment in general, right? There are different theories, different approaches to why we punish people for things. One is that punishment is a deterrence, right? And that's not what's going on here, I think, clearly. But sometimes we punish people because they, quote unquote, deserve it, right? That is one of our justifications for punishment. And that's essentially what's going on in Riley's mind.
Absolutely.
Kodos deserves to die. He's circumventing the legal process, but he is using the justification that our entire legal system uses, at least in some cases, to justify punishment. The notion that people get punished because, not just because it's a deterrent, not just to prevent future harm, but because people morally deserve it in some way. And it's hard to really spell out what exactly that means, to deserve something. It's a word. We use it. We understand it. But it's hard to give an analysis of what it means to have dessert in that way, right? To deserve something. But that's what's going on in Riley's mind. Kodos deserves to die. Kirk kind of waffles a little bit. He feels it a little bit too, but he's also trying to stop Riley from acting rashly. But I think it's very easy to criticize Riley for this notion that he wants to punish or take revenge on Kodos. Yes, it's circumventing the legal system. He's acting rashly, but that is one of the justifications for punishment that we use. So I don't know. I think certainly understand the emotion of revenge, but I don't think that's too disconnected from our notion of punishment in general.
No, I agree. But I think it's interesting that in this evolved 23rd century world, we still feel the need for revenge. And, you know, Riley being a Starfleet officer, and again, he's appealing to, I think, Captain Kirk's baser instincts. Kirk certainly seems to, at some point here in the episode, Kirk seems to agree. And in fact, he's willing to risk his own life to exact that revenge. I mean, even Spock is taken back, unsure that the captain's acting wisely and, you know, getting all mathematical and logical and
Well, Kirk says as much. He says, you know, I'm putting my own captaincy at risk here, but I'm going to find out if he's Kodos.
He wants to know, daggone it, and he's going to find out. Yeah, so this is a concept that supposedly we've evolved away from, but evidently not. It's alive and well in these two characters. And I think it's interesting at the end of the episode, you know, it's Captain Kirk who is essentially being criticized for not being very merciful, not being, you know, very human, that, you know, he's the one who stops Riley. He's the one really who is showing Kodos mercy, you know, to bring him to proper justice and not exact some, you know, kind of fleshly desire to have his revenge. I think that's very interesting. And again, it's this really great juxtaposition there, you know, between this baser instinct and this higher mindset.
I think you're hitting on something that to me feels like kind of a meta theme of the episode, right? The specific theme of the episode is personal identity and moral responsibility over time. The meta theme is whether we can transcend those baser parts of human nature, mm-hmm. right? Kodos is in a position where, you know, he's in an unfortunate position. He has to decide who lives and who dies, and he can't seem to transcend that baser nature, and he ends up becoming Kodos the Executioner. Kirk can't quite transcend, even as captain of a Federation starship in the 23rd century, can't transcend this drive towards revenge and these baser instincts. To me, this is a strong theme in Star Trek in general, and in this episode in particular. Star Trek seems to take the view that we can transcend those baser parts of our nature. We can learn, we can reflect, we can think, we can change. It might take 20 years, it might take 400 years, but we can do it. But this episode seems to show that, yes, we can do that to a degree, but those baser parts of our human nature will always be there lurking behind the scenes, and we're going to get pulled back into them ever so subtly and ever so gently. And before you know it, you are being the thing that you hate, no matter how evolved you think you are. And it's an interesting tension between thinking that we really do have the ability to change as individuals or as a species, but there inside of us is always the danger of reverting back to who we used to be or who we don't want to be, no matter how evolved we think we are. And that's kind of what Kodos is accusing Kirk of, and Dr. McCoy is accusing Kirk of, and mm-hmm. everyone seems to be accusing Kirk of in this episode, that, you know, he's claiming to be the evolved, you know, 23rd century modern man, you know, right smack in the middle of the 20th century, and this is film, but 23rd century. And really, he's being driven by these baser instincts like revenge while he's trying to take the moral high ground.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And I think that you've hit the nail on the head. I think within the episode, I think that's implicitly implied. But it's interesting to me because, you know, Kodos gives into his baser instincts, and that really becomes the premise for the whole episode. And those baser instincts have now visited his daughter, and she gives into him. Kirk almost gives into them.
Riley pretty much is.
Riley's gone. I mean, if it wasn't for Captain Kirk, he would have fired that phaser. I really believe that. If Captain Kirk hadn't have been there, he would have fired the phaser. And frankly, he would have spent the rest of his life living with the same same kind of, I think, weight, I will call it, that Kodos is living with, you know, 20 years trying to be somebody else, trying to forget, you know, that one mistake, that one moment in his own history where, you know, I did the thing that I shouldn't. Or maybe he spends the rest of his life trying to justify it and wrestling with it. And, you know, Kodos seems to be up and down through the episode. One minute he seems, you know, it seems that he's left it in the past and he's moved beyond it. And there are other times that he's trying to justify it. And other times he's saying, yeah, I'd do it again. So I kind of see each of these characters at different levels of transcending, you know, one of them still making excuses. And, you know, one of them is actively fighting those baser instincts. And you've got Captain Kirk who, yeah, I'm going to choose to be evolved.
Well, I think you're hitting on something. We've made this a very black and white discussion. Can you change or can you not change? Can you be responsible or not responsible? In reality, I think the first person phenomenological experience of this is that we really are both at the same time. We are different in some Sure. ways, and we're still our old selves. We think differently than we used to think, but we still remember how we used to think. we wouldn't do certain things again, but we remember doing them and we feel guilty about them. And we have to kind of balance those conflicting emotions and senses of self inside of us. And we never fully transcend, right? Some people do. You can ignore it, right? That's one way to do it. You can have that. You can have some sort of a radical experience by just ignoring all of that and doing, oh, I'm a totally different person and moving on. But for most of us who are a little bit reflective about things, we carry all those things with us all the time and we never do fully transcend them. It's not that we don't transcend them. It's that you're a little bit of both. You are, you know, the things you used to do and the ways you used to think and the person you used to be, but you're not anymore because you wouldn't do those things again and you understand things better now. And you're all the above. It's this bundle of, it's a gradual transition that's never fully completed.
To go back to an analogy, if you will, another character, if you will, that we brought into this, someone that I think to some degree informed the writer in writing Kodos / Caridian, the Apostle Paul. As I mentioned, he had this radical conversion experience that changed him in an incredible way. Overnight change that took place in his life. I mean, he literally, from one moment to another, was different, and everyone around him knew it. However, he spent the rest of his life struggling, much the same way that all of us do. And he said as much. He wrote in a letter that he had penned to the Christians in Rome, he said, "For I know that good itself does not dwell in me, that is, in my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do. This I keep on doing." That is a man in conflict, a man struggling, a man trying to be the best version of himself and realizing that he's still struggling with that old nature. Even though he'd had this radical experience, he was still wrestling with these baser natures. And I see a lot of that in the character Kodos. I see that going on in Riley. I see that going on in Captain Kirk. And I think to a great degree, it's not easy to just black and white these characters and say, okay, Kodos bad, Kirk good, Riley, you can't do that. But these are men who are in the thick of situations, making decisions, and some of those decisions are good, and some of those are bad, and they're going to have to live with the consequences of those decisions. And frankly, those decisions aren't going to just affect them, but they're going to affect the next generation. In one case, it was Lenore. In another case, it was Riley.
I think it's easy to look at the society we see in Star Trek, even in the original series in the 23rd century, and definitely in the 24th century and the next generation and on. We forget that there's a struggle in becoming who we think of those characters as being. We think of these characters as embodying certain traits or virtues that we aspire to here from our meager perspective in the early 21st century and then in the 20th century when this episode aired. But in reality, we forget that these characters struggle. And I think the original series shows this a lot, although we tend to look at the original series with rose-colored glasses a little bit. The Next Generation definitely falls prey to this, right? Having very idealistic characters, they don't have much of an inner struggle about their decisions, although we see some of that in Captain Picard and in certain instances. Other series did that better. Deep Space Nine, I think, that did that better. We see those characters struggle a lot more than the Next Generation characters did. But we forget that humans, even future humans, are going to carry that struggle with them. They might learn to deal with that struggle a little better. They might have better rules, better structures, better habits, better whatever that allows them to be that better version of humanity. I don't think it's likely at all that they will eliminate the struggle of being those people.
Absolutely. And I think to Lenore's question inside the episode, I don't think technology makes us any less human.
It doesn't take the struggle away.
It doesn't remove the struggle.
I think Kirk's point about technology as tools is relevant. A tool is kind of morally neutral. You can use it for good. You can use it for evil, right? Future humans will have different tools, and it will still they'll still have to struggle to do the right thing or do the wrong thing with them, to do good things or to do evil things with them. Technology is not going to solve the moral struggle of the future.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point, Zachary. And with that, I can only say it's been fun talking about Conscience of the King, Star Trek, the original series.
It's always fun to get a conversation about the original series and on Metatrex.
Always. But this isn't the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look, everyone. It's some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
I should have had my mom buy me everything because now it would be worth a ton, like the goofy Spock helmet. But I remember hooting at those things back in the day. You know, like, they think we're just stupid. That wasn't in the show. You don't have a real phaser wouldn't say Star Trek on the side of it.
Standard orbit.
I cannot find anybody in print saying,
we're going to the Standard Enterprise Delta to honor the Enterprise as being the first ship of the constellation, you know, the first of the five-year mission ships to come back relatively intact with its crew and ship intact.
And it was not a, some fan did not just say this. Somebody in the production somewhere, and someday, by God, I will find where this came from, because like we didn't all have this mass group hallucination about it. Somebody felt the need to say, everybody's wearing an Enterprise patch now, so, you know, that's past us.
To the journey!
So if we're going to have a more Vulcan-like Tom in Tuvom, presumably Tuvom would have to meditate, and he would have to go somewhere to meditate. I'm thinking he wouldn't just go to his quarters to meditate with candles like Tuvok does, or he wouldn't go sit on some rocks on a planet somewhere. He would go in the holodeck and lock himself in his Camaro and meditate with the radio on.
What would be playing on the radio?
Vulcan opera.
Ah, that sounds horrible.
Warp 5.
Shows the gestation of the Borg from their first cube and the diamond ships. Just transwarp conduits.
Floating on the ocean. Little Borg spacemen.
Yep.
Before they were fully immune to the outside elements, so they had little space helmets, Borg space helmets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party podcast apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts about today's show, and there are many ways for you to mind meld with us. The best place to join the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select Metatrex. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/Trek FM. Well, Zachary, when you're not brushing up on your Shakespearean acting skills, where can people find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM show dedicated to Star Trek Voyager, along with my co-host over there, Suzanne Williamson. You can always find me in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook, if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me in there. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And how about you, Mike, when you're not washing the stains from your hands with the waters from Great Neptune's ocean, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
You can always find me around Facebook. That's where I'm most active. I'm on Twitter as well. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm occasionally on Instagram. And you can always catch my blog about my journey to publish my novel. That is cmichael1701.wordpress.com. If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more. All available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month, so we really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network specifically. We'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. And we'd like to give a special shout out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can catch him on Twitter at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, her Twitter handle is at ChocoWeeble. Norm Lau, his Twitter handle is at Starfighter1701. And Mark Walker from Parts Unknown. Well, Zachary, we'd like to once more invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, as always, we want to thank you for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.